I'd like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries Committee to order. It is five after 10 on Tuesday, February 19th. And present are Representative Gaddis, Representative Tompkins, and myself, Chair Seaton, several other members who are delayed in other meetings. Today, we are going to be having an overview on Chinook salmon bycatch issues in the Gulf and the Bering Sea. And then we will have a presentation on herring and fish protein markets as well. So I want to remind everybody to silence their cell phones. And questions, of course, will come through the chair. And we've been joined by Representative Johnson. And we will first begin with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I think we have Nicole Kimball online. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Great. And Nicole, I guess there's you and Bob Clark. I don't know who's going to start, but go ahead and just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation for us.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Nicole Kimball, Federal Fisheries Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've been asked to provide a brief background on the regulatory measures in place to limit both Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon bycatch in the federal fisheries. So this is clearly a critical issue to the department, and in 5 minutes, I think I'll just be able to set the stage for more detail that you'll hear from other speakers. After a few minutes, I'll turn it over to Bob Clark, fisheries scientist for the department, to talk more about the stock composition of the bycatch and the department's research initiative. So as you know, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council with National Marine Fisheries Service is responsible for managing the federal groundfish fisheries, which includes the pollock fisheries, and the department clearly has a role in federal management through the commissioner's seat on the council. And the fishery at issue is the pollock fishery. It uses midwater trawl nets to catch pollock and also catches Chinook salmon incidentally during the fishery. So under the authority of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the council is charged with both minimizing salmon bycatch to the extent practicable while also trying to achieve the optimum yield in the pollock fisheries. So the Bering Sea pollock fleet, I'll start there, operates under a cooperative structure that was set out by Congress. It's not an open access fishery. It allows for the ability of the fleet to work cooperatively since they're not in a race for fish. And originally, since about the mid-90s, the only management measures to address bycatch were these large fixed closure areas, and they've applied to both Chinook and Chum salmon. So if the pollock fleet caught an amount of salmon in a particular area or time, that area was closed to pollock fishing. But that didn't limit the total amount of bycatch, and it appeared also in some years, in some particular seasons, we were actually exacerbating the salmon bycatch problem because we were moving boats out of a fixed area into other areas that actually had a higher rate of bycatch.
Okay, so Nicole, may I interrupt you for a minute? I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Herron and Representative Olson. So go ahead.
Okay. So from there, the council authorized the use of a rolling hotspot program. You've probably heard of that before, and I'm sure you'll hear about more about it from other speakers. It's a program essentially run by an organization called Sea State that the pollock fleet funds to track Chinook bycatch and close much more smaller, discrete areas based on a constant assessment of bycatch rates across the fleet and in all areas. And so while this appeared to work better than the fixed area closures in terms of overall salmon avoidance, it still didn't limit or have a total cap on the amount of Chinook salmon bycatch. So then the council worked for several years on a new bycatch avoidance program in the Bering Sea, which was just implemented in 2011. They retained the program that moves trawl vessels away from areas that have higher salmon encounter rates, but they also established the first hard cap on the fleet, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. If the cap is reached, the pollock fleet must stop fishing. And clearly, in recent years, bycatch has been highly variable, so there was concern that just putting in one simple hard cap wouldn't protect Chinook in years of low abundance, years like we experienced last year. So rather than one hard cap, the council adopted a system that provides a range of caps, and that depends on the fishery performance. So the overall pollock fleet has a high cap of 60,000 Chinook, and it has a lower cap of about 47,000 Chinook, and that's sometimes called the performance standard. So the program is structured such that the fleet is subject to the higher cap each year if they have incentive plan agreements in place that detail how they're actually going to stay under the lower cap. So if they hit the upper cap in more than 2 out of 7 years, they're subject to the lower cap permanently. And that dual cap system then is removed, and they're just subject to the lower cap. Because they don't want to risk hitting the upper cap, the polypleats are issued a portion of the lower cap, and they manage their operations to the lower cap each year. So they manage to the 47,000 Chinook. So I guess I'm trying to get across that the incentive plans are a key component of this program. It's not just the cap system. That basically the incentive plans are required to look at the bycatch of each individual vessel, and then they restrict pollock fishing for those with poor Chinook bycatch performance, and they allow those with better bycatch performance better access to the pollock fishing grounds. So in the shoreside sector, vessels that deliver pollock to processing plants in Alaska, the incentive program operates kind of on a continuous basis, meaning that under the incentives, a vessel increases its possibility of having restrictions in the future with every salmon that it catches. So it's an important aspect of the program that was important to the council to keep the pressure for avoidance of salmon on at all times. They understood that under a hard cap only system, a vessel wouldn't be treated any differently whether it had a bycatch level of 25% of a hard cap or 99% of a hard cap. So the incentive program was intended to make Chinook salmon bycatch a factor in every decision of the fleet, whether in a high salmon year or a year of really low Chinook abundance. So in 2012, the bycatch in the pollock fishery was just over 11,000 Chinook. The council will receive the salmon avoidance reports from the 2012 fishing year at its April council meeting. Those are required to be provided to the council at every April meeting. I know the state's going to be very interested to see those reports and understand what the fleet did to avoid Chinook in a very low salmon year in which they weren't even close to hitting the cap. Now, the Gulf of Alaska is very different. There's no cooperative structure or catch share system in place, so the trawl fisheries are essentially limited access fisheries, which means that there continues to be a race for target species before the season closes. And under this system, the council's primary management measure is just a hard cap, and that was implemented for the first time in August of last year. The cap in the Gulf is 25,000 Chinook in the pollock fisheries, and last year the fishery caught about 19,000 Chinook. And while the vast majority of Chinook are taken in the pollock fishery in the Gulf, the council is also scheduled to make a decision on setting a hard cap in other trawl fisheries, those that target species other than pollock, later this year. And I think I should also mention that in addition, the council is now working on a bycatch management system for the Gulf trawl fisheries that's intended to provide a level of bycatch incentives and cooperative management more similar to the Bering Sea in order to realize much more significant bycatch reductions than just a hard cap can provide. But that's a big structural change. That'll take some work, and for now what's in place is a hard cap. That concludes my overall comments, Mr. Chair, and I will turn it over to Bob Clark now if that's
okay. Thank you very much, Nicole.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Clark. I'm a fishery scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And you've heard that Nicole has described the management approaches for minimizing Chinook salmon bycatch in the federally managed groundfish fisheries. I'm going to talk briefly about what we know about the general stock composition of these Chinook salmon bycatches. In the Bering Sea, there is a very high level of fishery observer coverage of groundfish fisheries, so that sampling of individual bycatch Chinook salmon is possible. These bycatch Chinook salmon are sampled for length, age, and genetic tissues. From these data, federal scientists have been able to tell in general what stocks of Chinook salmon are being caught and are beginning to quantify the potential impact of this bycatch on runs of Chinook salmon here in Alaska. From records of bycatches, we know that most of the bycatch of Chinook salmon occurs during the A or winter season. We also know from genetic studies that the general composition of stocks bycaught changes from the winter A season to the later B season, with a higher proportion of Alaska stocks represented in the bycatch during the A season. From genetic sampling, we also know the general stock composition of the bycatch of Chinook salmon in the Bering Sea groundfish fisheries. For example, from sampling conducted during 2010, the bycatch was made up of about 42% what's called coastal western Alaska fish, which is a combination of Bristol Bay, Kuskokwim, Lower Yukon, and Norton Sound stocks. 20% came from upper Yukon River stocks, 14% came from North Alaska Peninsula stocks, and 11% came from middle Yukon River stocks. The other 13% of the bycatch that year was made up of a mix of Canadian, Lower 48, Russian, and Gulf of Alaska stocks. This general composition of stocks in the Bering Sea bycatch during 2010 was similar to that seen during sampling in 2005 through 2009. Genetic sampling of this fishery is ongoing, so we will continue to get estimates of the general stock composition of the bycatch into the future. As part of the Governor's Chinook Initiative and the Chinook Salmon Stock Assessment and Research Plan, Fish and Game is working to develop better genetic techniques so that we can separate out the different stocks from that large coastal Western Alaska grouping in the bycatch. We are also recommending higher levels of sampling of this bycatch so that more coated wire tag Chinook salmon can be recovered from this fishery, and if possible, to better resolve where and when bycatches of Alaska Chinook salmon are occurring and what individual stocks are being bycaught. The research plan also calls for new tagging programs for juvenile salmon in the Nooshigak, Kuskokwim, and Yukon rivers so that we can find out when and where these individual stocks are bycaught in these groundfish fisheries. As Nicole mentioned, the situation is very different in the Gulf of Alaska. There's been little to no sampling of Chinook salmon bycatch in federally managed groundfish fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska. However, as part of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's work in minimizing Chinook bycatch in these fisheries and its work in restructuring of the Fishery Observer Program, they're also making it possible for fishery observers to sample Chinook salmon from these fisheries so that we can find out what stocks are being bycaught and when and where they're being bycaught. Although we do not yet have representative samples from these Gulf of Alaska groundfish fisheries, sampling of Chinook salmon that has been done from research vessels over the years tells us that, in general, bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska groundfish fisheries is likely to be composed of very few to no Western Alaska Chinook salmon and a higher proportion of Gulf of Alaska, Canadian, and Lower 48 fish. Fish and Game, as part of the Governor's Chinook Initiative and the Chinook Salmon Stock Assessment and Research Plan, is recommending that bycatch of Chinook salmon in the Gulf of Alaska be sampled for length, age, genetic tissues, and coated wire tags. We are also working to better define the genetics of Gulf of Alaska stocks so that we can identify individual stocks from samples of the bycatch. The research plan also calls for additional tagging of juvenile salmon in Gulf of Alaska rivers so that we can see when and where individual stocks are bycaught in these groundfish fisheries. The research plan recommends new coated wire tagging programs for juvenile Chinook salmon in the Copper, Susitna, Kenai, Karlik, and Chignik rivers in the Gulf of Alaska. The research plan also recommends continued funding of coated wire tagging programs for four stocks of Chinook salmon in southeast Alaska, the Unik, Stikine, Taku, and Chilkat. That concludes my briefing, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Let's start with when you were saying the groundfish fisheries in the Gulf are in the Bering Sea, were you talking about all of them, or was that just the for the distribution of percentages of Chinook in that catch? Was that all of the groundfish fisheries, or was that just pollock?
Mr. Chair, this is Bob Clark, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Yes, that was for all groundfish fisheries, but most of the bycatch comes from the pollock fishery.
Okay, and the Gulf of Alaska, our understanding from, maybe we'll get more in subsequent testimony, but from the Gulf of Alaska guys is they had about 4,000 samples, scale and fin clip, I believe, samples, genetic samples that were waiting for analysis. Is that going forward now with the research lab? It was like there was a year backlog in that data, so they weren't getting the analysis. How's that coming?
Mr. Chair, this is Nicole Kimball. I think that you will get There is a backlog, so it's about a year backlog before we have samples identified and processed, and I think you will get additional information in the next presentation as well.
Okay, thanks, and I want to maybe come back to you if we're still looking at that backlog and have a little further discussion. So if you could stay online for that, I'd appreciate it. So we don't at this point in time have a estimate of the percentage of Gulf of Alaska stocks and the percentage of Canadian lower 48 stocks at this point in time. Is that what I...
Mr. Chair, yes, this is Nicole Kimball again. We have from the 2010 Gulf samples that predominantly they were from the Pacific Northwest, British Columbia, and coastal southeastern Alaska, but the results that we have to date are just providing a presence of these stocks rather than relative abundance. So you're correct in not having the percentages.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much for your input there, and we will hopefully we'll be able to get some further data from you later. And so now we'll go to our next presenter, which is Diana Stram. And Diana Evans, are you online from the North Pacific Fisheries Council?
Yes, I am.
Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed with your presentation.
Okay. My name is Diana Evans. Good morning. And I'm a fishery analyst for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. So hopefully you have been distributed a handout that summarizes the briefing that I'm about to give. We also provided a background paper, a reference paper, on this issue that I'm going to refer to during the presentation, but the handout should look like a PowerPoint handout as a PDF.
Great. And we do have a handout in front of us, and if you're addressing one slide to the next, if you could either give us a page number, we have these on two slides per page. So if you could either, I don't know how you have it, I presume this is a 2018-2013 presentation. So if you could just let us know which slide you're talking from, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yes, I can do that. So the council, I'm sure you're all familiar with the council, but the council manages the Federal Fisheries off Alaska in conjunction with the National Marine Fisheries Service under the requirements of the Magnuson-Stevens Act and its national standards. And as Nicole referenced in her presentation, the national standards do require a balancing of the need to minimize Chinook salmon bycatch to the extent practicable, while also achieving optimal yield for target fisheries and minimizing adverse impacts on fishing communities. Those are just some of the national standards, but those that relate to this issue. So with respect to salmon bycatch, this will be on page 2 of the handout. Specifically with respect to salmon bycatch, the council manages bycatch that occurs in the trawl fisheries. Salmon caught as bycatch are accounted for in our system, but by law they are prohibited species in the ground fish fisheries and they cannot be retained or sold. As Nicole mentioned, bycatch occurs primarily in the pollock fishery, although in the Gulf there's some bycatch in other target trawl fisheries as well. And you can see at the graph on the bottom of that page 2, shows the inter-annual variability in Chinook salmon encounters in the fisheries. Note the difference in scale between the Bering Sea pollock on the top and the Gulf on the bottom, that has a much smaller scale. But you can see from these graphs that the largest spike in the Bering Sea pollock fishery, Chinook salmon bycatch, occurred in 2007. Since then, the five-year average has been about 16,000 Chinook in the Gulf pollock fishery, which is the darker part of the graph, area of the graph on the bottom. The largest encounter occurred in 2010, so the five-year average of...
Diane, can you speak a little closer to the microphone? We're having... And a little slower. Yeah, we're having a hard time following.
Okay. I'll try to speak a little louder.
Oh, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. So I just kind of described the two graphs. You can see the pollock fishery on the top, and the five-year average is listed on that graph. For Gulf pollock, for the Gulf ground fish fisheries, the graph identifies both the pollock fishery that Chinook bycatch attributable to the pollock fishery and that attributable to other target fisheries, so flatfish, rockfish, and cod primarily. And the five-year average for the pollock fishery is about 18,000 fish, whereas for the other trawl fisheries is about 6,000 fish, looking at the last 5 years. So given that context, tried to focus on what action the council has taken to address Chinook salmon bycatch for this overview briefing.
Before you go on, there was a question on the retention or selling of the Chinook bycatch. One of the members wanted to know about, can you explain that a little more?
Sure. So in our ground fish fisheries, salmon are treated as a prohibited species. And so by regulation, and as part of the management plan, fishermen are required to avoid those species. Crab, salmon, herring, and halibut are all treated as prohibited. Fishermen are required to avoid them to the extent possible when they're fishing for target ground fish. And that bycatch, in general, is not allowed to be retained, although there are some measures in place, particularly for salmon, that require you to keep the salmon in order for it to be counted, and then it's not allowed to be retained or sold. I'm going to talk a little bit later on in the presentation about the opportunity for a food bank donation program that also exists under our management program as well.
Okay, and can you slow down just a little in your speech? Or
I will try.
Thank you. We have a couple questions. Representative Herring and Representative Grace-Donkin.
Diane, I guess what it says on the slide, by law, bycatch is counted but cannot be retained or sold. And the way you described it, I guess, why does, by law, why don't we have a provision where that salmon is all retained and utilized in some way? I understand the sold part, but why, explain the law. Why don't we want to, if we catch it, why don't we utilize it to its fullest extent? I don't get it, I guess.
So the reason that this was implemented originally in the management plans as a provision, that these species are defined as prohibited, was to be an avoidance incentive. So, this is a provision of our management plans that has been in place for the last 20 years since the management plans were first put into place. And the idea of implementing that type of provision is that if you're not allowed to keep or use something, you're not going to be, you as a fisherman have more incentive to avoid it so that you're not wasting your time catching something that you can't use. Obviously, over the years, the fishery has developed and our management measures have evolved and become more sophisticated, and people have become concerned about ensuring, looking at other techniques or other management measures to promote avoidance of salmon. And so we've started putting in place hard cat limits or other types of management tools. And that was part of the incentive, too, for the council. In 1996, they instituted a permission through the amendment that you could donate the salmon that you catch, or halibut, to a food bank program that would encourage full utilization of the species that you caught incidentally. But that was the rationale for originally putting in place those types of provisions, and that's the way our ground fish management program is structured.
Thank you. Representative Grace-Donkin.
Without full retention and limited observer coverage in the Gulf trawl fishery, how is the bycatch data for the Gulf trawl fishery calculated, and what kind of confidence do you have in that bycatch data?
So we have, in the Gulf of Alaska, as you say, we don't have full 100% observer coverage, but our observer program is designed to make, without 100% 100% sampling, to use a scientific method to provide the best estimates for the amount of catch. So catch on observed vessels is then extrapolated to catch on unobserved vessels using the closest approximation. So if you have vessels, for example, fishing in the same target fishery, you would use the data from an observed vessel in the same target fishery to extrapolate to an unobserved vessel in that same target fishery or by area. There's a number of different parameters for the way that that extrapolation occurs. Since implementing the new observer program in 2013, that provided a lot of additional tools to the agency to improve that extrapolation process by giving the agency control on randomization of observer coverage throughout the fleet. So beginning in 2013, we should be able to hopefully over the next couple of years develop a better quantification of what the confidence level or confidence intervals around the observer data that we get back from the Gulf fisheries will be. That program has only just gone into place, so that's going to be a little bit out in terms of timing for being able to have that type of result.
Follow-up program, Grace Tompkin.
My understanding is part of the motivation for the Council restructuring the observer program is that there's not a lot of confidence that the current observer program is accurately capturing data because of manipulation and observer tows, and so hence the new observer program. So what level of confidence do you have in current data coming from the Gulf trawl fishery, and maybe in specific terms, I mean, what are the confidence intervals you're talking about? What level of confidence do you have in extrapolation that you're using currently?
We don't have one of the things we're not able to do with the current data is to actually estimate confidence intervals for the data that we have. So yes, there's certainly uncertainty around those values. So if you're looking, for example, at the graph on the bottom of page 2 for the Gulf groundfish fisheries, some of that interannual variability is very likely to be a result of uncertainty or events that are driven through the extrapolation procedure. Nonetheless, we do have catch that is observed, so we have certainly a high level of confidence for the observed vessels that we have participating. For example, in the pollock fishery, which is a high pulse fishery, goes in short bursts, 4 seasons throughout the year. It is more difficult to, so some of the problems that you allude to in terms of having being able to manipulate the observer data, it's much more difficult when you have a high pulse fishery where you're trying to race for fish and the fishery is only open for a short period of time. Some of the things that you might be able to do to manipulate observer coverage or observer results would require you to sit out part of that fishery, and that's given the fact that the fisheries are such short fisheries, and it's important to most participants that they are able to engage in the fishery for the entire time that it's open, you're going to see less ability to manipulate observer coverage in those situations. Nonetheless, we can't estimate exactly what the confidence is around that data, those data points.
Okay, thank you. So I guess what we're hearing is in the pulse fisheries, you have more confidence in that because of people needing to fish or losing fish versus the other fisheries that are that people can pursue for a much longer time period. Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
Yes, I think that you have more confidence in information coming out of the Gulf pollock fishery than perhaps some of the other ones.
Okay.
But that's what the 2013 program hopefully does away with many of those issues by restructuring the program.
Thank you. Go ahead and would you identify which slide or which page you're on as you go?
Sure. I'm going to move to page 3 then. And I'm not actually going to spend a lot of time on these two slides because Nicole, I think, described pretty well the two management measures that have gone into place. So these are the primary management action the council has taken with respect to Chinook salmon bycatch is to put in place hard cap bycatch limits that close the fishery once the limit is reached. In the Bering Sea, the hard cap was implemented in 2011, and it's just described in the slide, but I think the Nicole talked to that, and we'll probably have other speakers talk to that as well. In the Gulf of Alaska, the bycatch limit was put into place in mid-2012 for the hard cap, and the council is also considering a hard cap for the non-pollock trawl fisheries as well. You can see the range of limits currently under review is 5,000 to 12,500 Chinook salmon, and council final action is scheduled for June. So moving on to page 4, I just want to talk a little bit about another action that the council is taking with respect to important action is to structure obtaining stock of origin information and research on stock of origin as part of our management programs that put in place the PSC limits. And obviously, as Bob Clark alluded to as well, the importance of this work is to understand how the individual stock composition of Chinook salmon that is caught as bycatch in the trawl fisheries relates to the impact of offshore bycatch. The impact of offshore bycatch affecting the status of individual Chinook stocks. So I think Bob has spoken to a little bit to some of this information, but if you look then to the slide at the bottom of that page 4 on the Bering Sea, in 2009 when the council took action on the PSC limit and the bycatch limit for the Bering Sea, the one that was implemented in 2011, they used genetic information from 2005 to 2007. That information was used to develop an adult equivalency model, which estimates when and how many salmon that were caught by catching the pollock fishery would otherwise have returned to the river of origin. I think Bob has actually identified some more recent information. He cited some 2010 research in terms of stock composition, but the analysis shows that Chinook salmon from coastal western Alaska do comprise the largest component of that bycatch, and other western Alaska river systems as well comprise the largest component of the bycatch in the Bering Sea. As part of the PSC limit implementation in 2011, the council also put in place measures to allow for a systematic sampling procedure for Chinook, so allowing a full census of all salmon that are caught at bycatch, and increased observer coverage, so that now there's minimum 100% observer coverage in those fisheries. The samples are analyzed, and a genetic breakdown of those is provided each April. So this coming April in 2013 will be the first time that the council receives a complete annual report based on the full census and the systematic sampling procedure, and that will be for the year 2011. So there is a somewhat of a delay, which you alluded to earlier in your questions, with Ms. Kimball, between the year, the complete year of sampling, and then the report that comes back to the council. And then finally, the bottom bullet there just refers to, or relates to the reference paper that I referred to, that I think has been handed out to you. It was prepared by our staff member, Diana Stram, and a colleague from the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. She extended the earlier council analysis with current data that she prepared for Alaska Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative Symposium in December. But if you look at the information in that paper, if you look at 2011, for example, bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery would have accounted for somewhere between 0.7 and 2.4% of the combined run sizes for Western Alaska. So that's the best information that we have on what the impact of bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery is to Western Alaska. Turning the page to page 5, looking specifically at the Gulf, again, Bob noted that the information in the Gulf is much more limited. We have very limited sampling for stock composition analysis. The information that we do have provides data on what stocks have been documented to be present in the Gulf of Alaska. So we have present information, but no indication of their relative abundance. But with the implementation of the hard cap in the pollock fishery, the council put in place a similar systematic sampling procedure for Chinook, also using a census approach approach, although we have low observer coverage in the Gulf pollock fishery, that the genetic information from 2011 will also be presented to the council this coming April, and the most recent year of data we have is from 2010. I think Bob Clark mentioned this as well, but the limited samples that we have available indicate that the stocks, Chinook stocks present in the Gulf bycatch are predominantly from the Pacific Northwest, British Columbia, and coastal southeastern Alaska. So not Western Alaska stocks, but primarily Gulf Canada or the lower 48. The council is also considering how to put in place requirements to allow stock of origin sampling in the non-pollock trawl fisheries as part of their action with those fisheries. But due to the differing nature of the fisheries, it seems unlikely that we'll be able to do census sampling. So the agency is currently looking at developing a different sampling methodology that could be used for those fisheries. And then on the bottom of page 5, just two other actions that the council has taken with respect to Chinook salmon bycatch. I'd like to note that the council did develop an extensive outreach program for the Bering Sea Chinook hard cap action, especially trying to, the purpose being to dialogue with coastal and interior communities prior to council action. And then we've talked about this a little bit already, but the council has a long-standing amendment in place that allows bycaught salmon to be donated to food banks. Participation, which is voluntary by industry, has increased substantially in both the Bering Sea and the Gulf in recent years. And you can see on the slide that what the number in terms of pounds of donations of salmon and halibut were in 2012. In the Bering Sea, about 73,000 pounds, and in the Gulf, about 30,000 pounds. And what proportion of that was salmon?
Thank you. We had a question from Representative Heron.
Yes, Diane. In that same PowerPoint, promote two-way dialogue. What is the definition of two-way dialogue as related to the council?
The purpose of the outreach program was to allow communities to have direct access, not just to receive a staff presentation, but also to have direct access to council members. So as part of the design of the program, individual council members went out to many of these different meetings or regional forums and were available to these communities rather than just sending a staff person to give a presentation on what the nature of the action was. The idea was to have decision makers actually present at these various different forums so that they could have feedback and communication with the communities directly, in addition to as to provide a background for them, the decision that was being made at the council level.
And follow up, Representative Heron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Diane. Is this two-way dialogue, has it been well received, both by the council members and the individuals out in those communities?
Certainly in terms of the council members, I think that all who participated, and I think that the intent was to try to get every council member to at least one of those different meetings. I think that was very well received, and that those council members found that experience to be very useful in both in the formal presentation at the meeting or formal dialogue and questioning at the meeting, but also offline being able to talk to constituents that don't usually attend our meetings or aren't often able to come to Anchorage to our discussions at our own council meetings. I believe that it was also well received by the communities. This program was primarily developed when we started looking at Chinook salmon action for the Bering Sea, and that format has continued through some of the subsequent actions, both looking at the Bering Sea chum action, some Arctic FMP work that the council's done, and some of the other council actions that involve stakeholders that are further afield than perhaps the stakeholders that generally attend our meetings.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kreis Thompson.
A couple of questions. The first is, why is the council still awaiting 2011 genetic data from the Gulf fishery? And my second question, if you don't mind my lumping two unrelated questions, is what is the total poundage of Bering Sea salmon and halibut bycatch relative to the 73,000 pounds that was donated to food banks. So what proportion is that 73,000 pounds of the total bycatch? And what proportion is the 30,000 pounds of donated Gulf of Alaska salmon and halibut of the total bycatch for that fishery?
So with respect to the first question about the 2011 data, my best answer is that that's the way that the system we have set up. When we requested that we wanted to start getting regular, start increasing the sampling for genetic sampling in these fisheries, both in the Bering Sea and then subsequently in the Gulf of Alaska fisheries, we stepped up the number of samples that we would be taking and then processing, and obviously to come up with the genetic composition. With in our dialogues with the National Marine Fisheries Service, who provides that genetic analysis for us, I think in partnership with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and using their genetic baseline, that was the schedule that they said that they could meet in terms of getting information back to us. So that's the reason why we have that 16-month time lag between the end of the completion of the fishing year and then processing of the samples, the development of the stock composition report, and the associated quality control that's required to then come up with a stock composition analysis for the council. With respect to your second question, that's a very good question, but I'm afraid on the fly I'm not able to provide you that proportion. I can certainly get that information back to you, but I don't have that information.
And that would be fine to just send it in to us. We are running short on time, so let's go ahead and wrap up, Diane.
Sure. Very quick wrap up. Page 6 of the slides just identifies that even though I focused on actions that the council's taken that target Chinook salmon bycatch, council also considers how other affections will affect Chinook salmon. Recent examples being Bering Sea chum salmon bycatch, and I think that this slide is straightforward, but the idea that the council's been working to identify management measures that both effectively reduce chum salmon but don't undermine existing Chinook salmon bycatch measures, and that's a continuing work. And then Nicole already mentioned bycatch management tools for the Gulf of Alaska are underway, looking to provide those types of additional tools to reduce bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska as similar to those that are available in the Gulf. And then the final slide just shows, in summary, that this is a continuing priority for the council. We try to achieve bycatch reduction through a number of different mechanisms, both combining hard cap limits with incentive programs and research. And there is a system in place for regular reporting of Chinook salmon bycatch levels, both at every meeting and then also annual reports on genetics and from the fleet that allow the council to react to potential problems.
And thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation, and if you can send us that other information, that'd be great. Next we have Stephanie Madsen from Etsy Processors, and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Special Committee on Fisheries. Well, Louie gets my PowerPoint up and running for you. First, thank you for the opportunity to come before you. My name is Stephanie Madsen. I'm Executive Director of the Etsy Processors Association, a longtime Alaska resident, currently live here in Juneau. Mr. Chairman, this is an important issue. It's a complex issue, and I'm afraid that in my 7 minutes, I'm not going to be able to give it dedicated time. I'll try to focus and get to the point here for you, but I would encourage you to maybe schedule at your convenience more information about some of our programs and some of the efforts on ongoing salmon bycatch reduction.
And just for everybody's information, this is only the first of our hearing on the Chinook salmon issues that we'll be looking at, so we would invite you back again.
Okay. And I don't have a red light, green light, so just give me a high sign when I get close on my time. The ATSI processors are a trade association of six companies that own and operate catcher vessels that operate solely in the Bering Sea. So we catch and process pollock in the Bering Sea fisheries. We are not, we are restricted from fishing in the Gulf of Alaska for some time. So we would just be talking about Bering Sea salmon. We are also partners and owned by several of the community development quota groups in the state of Alaska. Amendment 91 is an innovative approach to managing Chinook salmon bycatch in that it combines a prohibited species catch limit on the amount of Chinook salmon that may be caught incidentally by the fishery with an incentive plan agreement, which we call IPA, and performance standard requirement designed to minimize bycatch to the extent practical in all years. The approach is designed to motivate fishery participants to avoid Chinook salmon bycatch at the vessel level, which I think is an important note, under any condition of pollock and Chinook bycatch in all years. Mr. Chairman, as you've heard, Amendment 91 is the number of the amendment that implemented this action. And it has limits, as you've heard. Here on this slide is just an example of the numbers of salmon that are distributed among sectors. We have four sectors in the Bering Sea: inshore, which you'll hear from Mr. Payne in a minute, the mothership, which are catcher vessels that deliver to three motherships in the Bering Sea, the CDQ program, and then the catcher processor sector, which is the sector that I'm going to speak to. I noted that the important difference between any kind of rolling hotspot closure that you've heard about in the past or that we operated in the past is that this amendment requires it to be at the vessel level. So all of our actions need to be at the vessel level, not at the cooperative level, and that's a huge change for this program. So this is just how our sector would allocate the salmon. We are managed by sector. And so we would distribute it down to the company. The company would then tell us how much salmon and pollock that day one allocation. And I think, Mr. Chairman, we have provided you our first annual report. Sorry about the length, but that will give you much more detail. And you'll see in there a chart that talks about our day one allocations for our fleet. I'm not going to spend any time on these slides, but the important thing here is that you've heard is that the incentive plan agreement needed to be meet certain requirements, and these are listed here. It's after the fact that this is what the council told us our incentive plan agreement had to have. So this, we went on to work and develop a program that was submitted and approved by National Fisheries Service in 2010, and it took place in 2011. Our IPA includes all of the catcher processors prosecuting the pollock fishery and all of the CDQ groups because we harvest their pollock on our vessels. Amendment 91 also changed observer coverage for the inshore fleet. It's now at 100%. It requires a series of video cameras on catcher processors to ensure that all salmon are accounted for. It's a continuation of, on our fleet, we have two federal observers at all times. And it moved the whole fleet, as you've heard, to a census for accounting for salmon, not an extrapolation. So every salmon is retained, counted by an observer, so we call that a census. When you talk about the genetic work and the sampling, the protocol for that is every 10th salmon that comes aboard is sampled. When we went on to identify for our offshore fleet the kind of incentive plan agreement, we really looked at salmon bycatch, and we were required to look at it at low, moderate, and high levels of both pollock and salmon. So we chose to use bycatch avoidance areas. We understand that there's an incentive if you're a catcher processor to have good flow of product, and so if you're restricted from areas of good pollock fishing, that's the hammer. The carrot is, if you can improve your bycatch performance at the vessel level, then you would not be restricted from those areas. So there, that incentive. So along with that, you have to identify bycatch avoidance areas. You have to decide who's allowed to fish inside. And then if it's excluded, how long is it excluded? So our primary IPA components include data gathering, monitoring, reporting and information sharing, identification of bycatch avoidance areas, and fishing area prohibitions for vessels with poor bycatch performance. Additional components, Mr. Chairman, include one, an A-season closed area of approximately 755 square nautical miles on the northern flank of the Bering Canyon, and two, a set of conditional B-season closed areas of approximately 1,295 square miles along the outermost eastern Bering Sea shelf. We've been looking at, as you know, we have hired C-State for many, many, many years. This is just an example of the kinds of data that we get. This is for A season in 2007. So as you can see, we know where the feed is fishing, we know where the hot spots are, and you can see here all of the inner co-op closures that occurred during A season of 2007. This, Mr. Chairman, illustrates all Chinook closures that were affected at affected catcher processors from 2006 to 2012. So based on that information, we chose to identify core areas. So as you look, you can we've used this history. So we've looked at these core areas based on 4 years of data that include all historic areas of high salmon encounters. It is anticipated that closure areas will be drawn from these core areas unless there is strong evidence that salmon distribution is different. One of the reasons, as you heard already, Mr. Chairman, is that what you don't want to happen is you don't want to close an area and force a fleet into a higher area of Chinook salmon bycatch. So it is a balancing act. So here's the details of how we identify those areas. It's used a base rate of pollock, Chinook bycatch against pollock. We have a starting way that we start the season. It's a rolling three-week average. And then we have a floor. I'm going to go pretty quickly, but this, okay. Vessel bycatch performance is calculated using a two-week rolling sum of average of pollock catch in Chinook. And if a vessel has a bycatch rate higher than 75% of the base rate, that vessel must fish outside the bycatch avoidance areas during that current week. Additionally, we have another test, and that is based on the numbers of total salmon, and we call that the X rolling hotspot closure. So we chose a benchmark of 85,000 Chinook, and so every vessel gets their Chinook on day one allocations. We monitor that, and when it reaches 63%, I believe, of the benchmark for that vessel, when it is shut out of an area, it is shut out for an additional week. So we have two incentives, not only a base rate vessel performance, but also total salmon caught.
And that was 8,500 and not 85,000, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Because, Mr. Chairman, you have to you see the big number, but that's divided by sectors. And so our total sector, I think, from that first slide is about 17,000 total per year. Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of details, as I pointed out, and some of them are operational. Because I manage the co-op's use of salmon, we have rules internal to our co-op that ensure that we will not exceed our performance standards. Because as you heard, if we exceed our share of 47,000 in any 2 years out of seven, then we only have access to our share of 47,000, and that could be pretty dramatic. So we have what we call a market buffer. There we go. Let's see. We have a market buffer and a limit buffer.
And Stephanie,
you're going to stop me right there.
Yeah, I think that this is a good point because I think that getting into the details of those, we've got the slides.
And I just want to point it out, finally, you have the 2011 report, and it has this chart in it. I want to update you with some draft numbers. So our fleet in the A and B season for 2012 harvested 545,014 metric tons of pollock, and we did that with only, I know the number is a lot to one that every salmon counts, but our total Chinook bycatch for last year was 2,933 salmon. All of our members carry salmon excluders, and we are involved in the food bank program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and definitely appreciate it, and sorry that we're having to cut things short. Should have had more time. We're going to run over here in this portion anyway, but thank you very much. So Stephanie will review this, and we'll have you back at another time.
Okay.
So thank you. And now we have AMCC, Pete Whedon, and I believe Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, Art Nelson. And I wanted to recognize this time that a fair while ago we were joined by Representative Feige. Could you identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Seaton and members of the Special Committee on Fisheries. My name is Pete Whedon. This morning I am representing an organization that I've belonged to since 1995. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is a family of seafood harvesters from all over Alaska and is dedicated to protecting the long-term health of Alaska's oceans and sustaining the working waterfronts of our coastal communities. Our members include fishermen, subsistence harvesters, marine scientists, small business owners, and families. Our ways of life, livelihoods, and local economies depend on productive oceans. We believe that coastal residents have a valuable and unique perspective on the marine ecosystem and have the right to meaningful and influential participation in decisions. I am here today to add our perspective to this discussion of Chinook salmon bycatch and bycatch in general. Bycatch is simply that which is caught that is either unintended or prohibited. In the case of Chinook salmon, it is a prohibited species or PSC. Although there is a measure of observation on the midwater and bottom trawl vessels that prosecute the pollock and other ground fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, we believe the numbers are even higher than those reported. Some Chinook salmon are discarded over the side during deck sorting, but given the pace of the fishery, most are simply washed down the chute with the targeted species catch. In the Gulf of Alaska, these fish are observed in the processing plant, where they are ground up and discarded after being counted and sampled. Under the old observer program, most vessels were observed 30% of the time, but some not at all. Under the new program, vessels under 60 feet will be observed, but coverage will be lower on the vessels that were covered 30% of their trips. It should be noted that since 2011, all vessels in the Bering Sea have had at least 100% observer coverage. Many of the Chinook and Chum salmon that are salvageable are retained, processed, and distributed through a program called SeaShare. Although we commend the effort and recognize the good of sharing the waste, our goal is to reduce the waste of our most valuable resources. The Gulf of Alaska non-pollock trawl fishery is operating without a cap on Chinook salmon bycatch. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Campbell made a motion at the December North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting that would address this management deficiency. There is a range of alternatives included in the motion, and two of the elements that we think are important are full retention of all PSC and a Chinook cap of 5,000 fish. This alternative represents the only choice for a meaningful reduction in Chinook bycatch. When the Council recently placed a cap on the pollock fishery in the Gulf, after a high Chinook bycatch of 54,000 kings in 2010, the cap was set higher than the 10-year average. This is not a meaningful reduction, but at least it prevents the waste of more than 25,000 Chinook. We do not know the proportions, but we do know that they are catching salmon from rivers that flow into the Gulf of Alaska. Some of these rivers include those in your district, like the Kenai, the Kasilof, Nanilchik, Susitna, Karluk, and many others around the Gulf. As you are aware, there are many rivers that the Department of Fish and Game have listed as stocks of concern, both in the Gulf and the Bering Sea. In 2012, both commercial and recreational fishermen faced severe closures due to low Chinook returns. We would ask that the council at this time would share this pain and cap the Gulf of Alaska non-pollock trawl fisheries to a Chinook cap of 5,000. We do not believe that this bycatch of Chinook is the answer to all the problems facing this stock, but we do know that this is something we can and should do. Looking at the charts of catch versus bycatch from various targeted fisheries and various vessels, we find that some are fishing cleaner than others. Given the present race for fish, it seems that we will be rewarding those that have the highest bycatch with the most quota. The discussion has begun in the Council to pursue the catch share program for the Gulf of Alaska ground fisheries. This is the tool that the trawl industry says is essential to bycatch reductions. We must recognize the shortcomings of past programs and commit to doing things differently this time. all impacted community members should have an opportunity to provide meaningful input. For any management program design, goals must include significant and meaningful bycatch reductions with 100% observer coverage, mechanisms to reduce capital flight of the fisheries resource, direct allocations to community fishing associations, avoid granting fishing rights into perpetuity, maintain opportunity for crew, processing workers, and support industries, maintain entry-level opportunity, limit excess consolidation in the harvesting and processing sector, promote active participation by vessels and quota owners, provide ecosystem protections. Mr. Chairman, I noticed the two-way dialogue, and I would encourage the council to continue this practice, as it is very difficult for many stakeholders to travel to Anchorage and beyond to testify for 3 minutes. This is a good example of how the system should work, but for now, we ask that the legislature speak for the people in your districts and communicate with the council our desire to continue bycatch reduction. Thank you.
Thank you.
One more.
Questions? Seeing that this time we are running late, and I think we have Art Nelson. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Art. We are running late, but would you go ahead and proceed with a short presentation? And we, again, we will be coming back to Chinook bycatch and Chinook salmon issues throughout this session.
I sure will, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Art Nelson. I'm a policy director for Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. We're a nonprofit with a board of directors and membership representing commercial and subsistence fishermen in Western Alaska from Bristol Bay up to Kotzebue and into the interior along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. And I'm just going to speak to the Bering Sea perspective of Chinook bycatch today. The council adopted Amendment 91, which was their Chinook bycatch measures, and it was implemented in 2011. At the time of its adoption, this coastwide failure of Chinook stocks that we're seeing now hadn't yet occurred, but at the time, they were aware that the Yukon River stock was already trending downward significantly, and Eastern Norton Sound Kings had been in crisis for nearly a decade. According to the Environmental Impact Statement, at the time of Amendment 91's passage, stock composition estimates of Chinook bycatch in the Bering Sea showed that approximately 56 to 67% were from Alaska rivers draining into the Bering Sea, which is Western Alaska, the Yukon, and the Northern Alaska Peninsula stocks. More recent information, as pointed out by Bob Clark earlier, indicate that it could be even higher, with up to 87% of the samples that were analyzed being Western Alaska and Peninsula stocks. As the council moved toward final action on the plan, both the Alaska Board of Fisheries and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, among many other management organizations responsible for salmon management, all urged them to adopt a much lower cap than they ended up adopting. I believe most of their recommendations were around 32,000 as a hard cap. And since the council's action on limiting bycatch in the Bering Sea, things have only gotten worse for Western Alaska king salmon, and the crisis has kind of spread throughout other parts of the state, including South Central. The Yukon River has been declared a fishery disaster for every single year since 2008, and has been listed as a stock of concern by the Board of Fisheries since 2000. Throughout the 1980s and the 1990s, commercial harvest of kings in the Yukon were regularly over 100,000 fish annually, and residents throughout the river also were enjoying healthy and relatively stable subsistence harvests of king salmon. However, the recent five-year commercial harvest is down over 96% from the full range, from the full 28-year average, 1980 through 2007. Subsistence lifestyle has also been impacted significantly by the poor runs. Subsistence harvests have failed to meet the minimum amount necessary for subsistence, as determined by the Board of Fisheries, in every single one of the past 5 years. And that amount necessary for subsistence is 45,500 to 66,704 king salmon for the Yukon. Additionally, we failed to deliver the minimum negotiated treaty amount of king salmon into Canada for three of the last 5 years. Besides affecting the harvest of king salmon by Canadian residents, this also fails to provide escapement needs when king salmon spawned in Canadian waters have historically represented about half of the entire Yukon drainage production of king salmon. In Norton Sound, the Uinkleet and Shaktulik rivers are the major Chinook producing systems, and they've been listed as a stock of concern since 2004 by the Alaska Board of Fisheries. The escapement goal in the Uinkleet River has only been met in three of the last 5 years, and when escapements were met, it was only because of significant subsistence fishery restrictions. There hasn't been a directed king salmon commercial fishery since 2001, and using the most recent five-year averages for Norton Sound, commercial harvest of king salmon is down 98%, and the subsistence harvests are down 67% from historical averages. The bycatch of Chinook salmon comes off the top from what subsistence, commercial, and sport fishermen get to take along the coast and in the rivers. It's fortunate that bycatch in the Bering Sea has been relatively low for the past couple years, but when you apply the estimates of stock composition to even the current bycatch amounts, what you've got is an estimated amount of Yukon fish that's about the same as what the commercial fishermen in the river are allowed to take, and they're prohibited from selling it and have to retain it for subsistence use. They don't have a directed commercial fishery for kings on the Yukon anymore. While the pollock fishery celebrated a low bycatch of about 11,000 kings this last year, subsistence fishermen on the Kuskokwim River got tickets on their net seized for trying to catch a few kings to put on their fish racks. What's really alarming is that at any time, the Amendment 91 passed by the council could allow the pollock fishery to take up to 60,000 kings, and that would represent somewhere around 30,000 to 40,000 Alaska origin fish, and perhaps as many as 13,000 Chinook salmon bound for the Yukon River alone. At current run strengths, Western Alaska fishermen are already assuming that their commercial harvest to kings is foregone, and that bycatch amount would have dire consequences to in-river management, most likely resulting in even more restriction to subsistence users who are already not meeting their needs. Especially at these low levels of abundance, every king salmon counts. The Bering Sea Fishermen's Association has and will continue to ask the council to revisit their Chinook bycatch measures to account for the recent and much more dire stock statuses and shoulder a more equitable share of the burden of conservation. Mr. Chairman, aside from whatever action you guys may be looking to take regarding Chinook salmon bycatch, I'd also urge you to support the state's research initiative that Nicole and Bob Clark spoke to a little bit earlier, as well as Representative Herron's House Bill 49, which would create a research endowment for Chinook salmon research. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Art. Appreciate that. Are there questions for Art? Seeing none, thanks again. And I think we had Brent Payne online, but Brent, we're going to have another hearing, and I would like to ask you to, if you can join us on teleconference at that time. We don't want to just cut everything too short here. It's a topic that we're going to be dealing with, and we want to deal in detail. So at this time, I'm going to go to our second half, which is Bruce Schockler presenting on herring and fish protein markets. And we'll take a short at ease while we reset the presentations. Bring this meeting of House Fisheries back to order. And welcome. Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent? And go ahead with your presentation.
My name is Bruce Schockler. I'm the Global Food Aid Director with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. This is Nina Schlossman, Dr. Nina Schlossman. She's our nutritionist and our project coordinator around the world for these different programs that we're working on. I'm here today to talk to you about a couple of programs that we're working on. Some of you may have been at the briefing last year, I think at the it was the Bush Caucus, or I don't remember which it was, but unfortunately we didn't have a room big enough to cater it for lunch like we did last time, and maybe we'll get a different opportunity to let you taste the wares. But We have the first project I wanted to talk to you about is it's the Alaska Herring Development Project. You know, we've been in the business here for this program of introducing new seafood products into the World Food Programs, and it's been going very well. We've been at it here for about 10 years on behalf of the state. We first started working on this to get rid of to address the oversupply of canned salmon we had back in the day, the early 2000s, and it's been such a hit that we are actually don't have enough salmon anymore. So we started looking at some other things that we can use that would benefit the industry, benefit the state, and bring economic development to coastal Alaska and to the state as a whole. What we came up with was looking at some of the new seafood different species and what we could do with them on an economic basis, and we came up with herring. Herring is, of course, eaten all over the world, and you know, in Europe they eat it for breakfast. There's approximately 4 million tons of herring produced in the world. So Alaska's got such a little dinky amount of it. We got about 10% of the harvest of the world, and most of it is concentrated on the roe fishery. When you're looking at something where you're harvesting for just the eggs, half the fish have no value whatsoever. That would be the males, and so we decided that this was a place that we could look at some new economic development. The world market for roe herring is very, very poor. It's a mere shadow of what it was 10 years or so ago. The economy, just the social changes, kids would rather eat a burger instead of some of that nasty old eggs. So the value of the resource has gone down drastically. The fishermen in several parts of the state are not can't even sell the herring anymore, specifically in northwest Alaska, western Alaska, north of Togiak. Those fish are virtually untouched. There are several places in the Gulf and in the southern Bering Sea that are also not fished anymore, just for lack of a market. So we picked that this particular product for those reasons, and began working on that. Canned herring, like I say, it's a shelf-stable product, and in the food aid business, one of the reasons canned salmon is such a huge hit is that it is shelf-stable. You know, you can do anything. You can dang near drop it out of an airplane into the, and you know, you don't have to cook it. You don't need potable water with it. You know, it's good to eat right there. The rats don't eat it. It doesn't get rained on. I mean, there's just it's bulletproof, and it's very, very popular around the food aid community, which, by the way, it's almost a $3 billion market. So we looked at this as being a new market for Alaska seafood products, and we began working this herring and designing it around the same success we had with with introducing salmon into this particular market. Just to give you an idea of the success we had with salmon on behalf of the state, we started this in 2004 with approximately 10,000 cases were used in a food aid program. Now we have actual sales this year in 2012 of over $10 million. Requests. I mean, people would like the product if it were available, and if the federal process for procuring that would grant all those requests of almost the entire pack. So we've done the project that we set out on for salmon was so successful that we decided that we'll just do the same thing with herring. So thank you to the state of Alaska, the governor's office, United Fishermen of Alaska, have all helped fund this project. We've been working on it for 2 years. The idea was in any development, research and development project, is to try to keep your expenses down and work with what you have until you figure out what's going on. And we were able to use a lot of existing machinery that the salmon business has without having to. We had to procure some specialized equipment that's specifically meant for processing herring. But we found a partner with some equipment. It happens to be Ocean Beauty Seafoods. They happen to have a year-round plant, and they also happen to have the machinery, the specialized machinery that would actually work to get these herring into an existing salmon can. They were the only ones we could find that actually did. So that was good that we didn't have to get into any new equipment for that. We have bought some specialty equipment, a fillet machine and a scaling machine, to get rid of the scales and to ready the fish to put in the can. So last year we put together an entire container, and that which was canned up. You have an example of that here. It's the same can they're using in industry to put the boneless salmon products you see in the store.
And I'm going to just interrupt you. Representative Tarr is coming in. We asked her to come to the table and join us. So go ahead and proceed.
Thank you.
Okay. So as I said, we did have to purchase some specialized machinery. And once again, thank you to everyone that's the state and ASME, governor's office, UFA, to help support being able to put that together. Once we had the cans together, we had identified an NGO in the food aid business, where the priority, sort of the market countries for World Food Aid is primarily in Africa. That's where there's so much work being done with the Department of Agriculture, with the State Department that runs the two major programs that we're involved in. And so we put together a partner. It's actually Samaritan's Purse, who actually does a lot of work in Alaska, up in the interior, in a lot of disaster. They spend a lot of time here. So they are our private volunteer organization. We've worked with one prior on this herring program in Uganda several years ago on our very, very first pilot program to see if this was going to work and if they really liked it. And Dr. Schlossman, who travels all over the world on behalf of Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, as well as the Department of Agriculture, and with her own private business assessing programs. And we're very fortunate that she's been able to take this with these different this canned product with her for different smaller tasting and usage demonstrations, focus groups around the world for the last several years. So this spring we shipped this one particular container over to Liberia. That happens to be where our Salesian missions we work with over in Cambodia.
And Bolivia.
And Bolivia with our salmon project. So they had this project going in Liberia. And something we haven't done before, with salmon is even, more of a common product worldwide. And it was much more common within the Department of Agriculture, your staff, just like you guys, you know, you need to, your staff needs to understand, you need to understand, everyone needs to understand that, you know, that, that people like this product, they, this is how they use it, that, you know, that they want more of it. We can do this in any culture, in any country. It's really no different than introducing, you know, a new brand of potato chips into the in, into the market. It's just another product in a different market, but the process is the same. You got to get everybody comfortable with it, and we've done that. Dr. Schlossman has been throughout the government agencies, and we have the International Food Aid Convention we go to every year to get everybody comfortable with working with this particular product and to understand it and to tasting. So we took this over to Liberia, and one of the things we hadn't ever done before, and with the funding we had, we wanted to try it, was to do a little bit more than just showing people how they eat it, but we wanted to show the nutritional impact that this type of a product has. You know, the canned fish that we have is the only animal protein in all of World Food Aid. Solid protein. The only other one is some powdered milk. Other than that, our canned seafood is that's it. Everything else is plant-based as far as protein goes. And as any nutritionist will tell you, you just can't do with plant protein what you can do with animal protein, especially when you're really into the what nutrition is all about and what's needed for malnourished folks. So I wanted to pass this over to Nina for just a minute, and let her tell you what the point of the exercise was, what our, you know, and how we went about it, and what I think you'll be very surprised at the outcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Can you pull the mic over and identify yourself for the record?
Okay. I'm Nina Schlossman, working with the ASME Alaska Global Food Aid Program on nutrition and the food aid programs, based in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to share some of these really exciting results with you. As Bruce said, one of the, you know, introducing canned salmon, canned herring, seafood powder, any of these products to a new market is, you know, it's a lengthy process, and everybody really wants to know not only how does it taste, how can I cook with it, how can I make it fit into my local cuisine, but also in the food aid arena, the problem with, you know, there's a billion people who go to bed hungry every night or who are undernourished. And so the canned salmon and, you know, now the canned herring, we hope, and some of the other seafood products are really a major improvement in the nutritional quality of the food aid basket. That's something that we work on a lot in our other work, as well as with ASME. And one of the reasons I like working with these products is it's something I can find in my supermarket. It's not, you know, a number two bean or a broken rice. It's a really highly nutritious product. And the only place that you can get marine protein or omega-3s, and they're very important. And one of the things that we had wanted to do and hadn't had the opportunity until this past year, thanks to the generosity of Alaska, was to work with people with HIV and AIDS. And Samaritan's Purse had, you know, has a wonderful program. They work with the whole gamut, you know, abused women, children in preschools, women and babies, and people with HIV. And with the almost 63,000 cans that were donated, about 500 women and their babies and adults with HIV in five programs were able to benefit for the last 9 months. And you know, we went over, we started last April, went over and trained project staff and had a weigh and measure the kids, worked with the cooks in the programs to develop recipes, and of course, you know, we were there to test acceptability. We thought, well, you know, maybe they won't like it, or maybe they'll like it just a little bit, and we have to do some actual work with them. From the first tasting, from the first bite, everybody loved the product. Liberians love fish, and they put it in every meal if they could, and even if they're serving chicken, they'll put fish with it if they have it. So it was that was something that we didn't realize, but so it was a no-brainer in a sense. They really loved it. So we interviewed the consumers, and then we measured the impact over the last 9 months. So as I said, the acceptability is very high. These are some kids in one of the preschools, and they're getting a meal of rice and herring with some greens. And they really are extremely grateful to Alaska for donating the product, and they'd like to see how they can get more. But the more important thing is that, you know, there was overall in those five different programs, 42% of the malnourished individuals improved to a normal, healthy nutrition status. And so and the improvement was even more significant in the adults overall. The kids already had school meals, so it was just an addition, a tasty addition nonetheless. But the most exciting part for us is that the herring really delivers improved, measurable nutritional benefits for people with HIV. Here's a woman in one of the programs getting her monthly allotment, and you can see she's putting it in a lapa, which is a big cloth that she can carry on her back. The impact on nutrition, 71% of the HIV positive malnourished participants improved their nutritional status. This is unbelievable. And really, I think, you know, you should pat yourselves on the back for being part of this amazing, building of the evidence. And more important than that, 80% of them improved to normal. Now, giving the herring out every month was part of a counseling program, which also provided medicine. And by providing the canned salmon, they were more likely, obviously, to come. The canned herring. They were more likely to come back on a monthly basis. So they not only benefited from the herring, but they also benefited from getting more counseling and making sure that they got their medicine every month. And
I might add that the thing about it, this is the only difference in their diet. Nothing else was added. Their diet continued to stay the same as it had been prior to that. The only thing that was added was eating the herring three times a week.
Four
times a week.
They got four cans a week, and they could eat it. Now, they didn't, you know, they really liked it a lot, so they ended up eating most of it in the first part of the month, and so they had it every day until it ran out, and then they didn't have it for the rest of the month. But luckily, it was a cumulative effect, so it all worked out. And we just, I had a team just went out this last month, and they just came back. They did, a second assessment. They made sure that the people who were doing the measurements were doing them correctly, because when we got preliminary results, we couldn't believe that they were really so good. And in fact, especially in the programs with the HIV-positive people, they really did the weighing and measuring accurately. So we're positive about these results. And it's really adding to the evidence base. And so many of the programs, especially in Africa and Southeast Asia, are programs where people with HIV are involved, our beneficiaries. It's very significant.
So from there, what's next?
What we have now, it's been so successful that they've asked, you know, well, what about other? We need to see this in some in another climate, in another culture. They worked over here, but what about, for example, Southeast Asia or South America? We're planning to do another program this spring. We'll be canning some herring, this time not from frozen, but from fresh, as a part of the onward development, research and development here of actually doing it from fresh product, which is going to be very interesting. We've never done that before. And so thanks to Ocean Beauty Seafoods and the equipment and the plant that they have, we're going to do that this spring. But we will be canning another container. Because this has been such a success, and we've had, you know, the whole community, the whole food aid community has been watching this. They interact with us fairly regularly for updates. We now have two different NGOs that are ready to buy this stuff today. They'll buy it with their own money. We're working in Washington, D.C. through the bureaucracy of the Department of Agriculture to actually get this as an official product on the grocery list, so to speak. Right now, if they wanted to buy it through the food aid business, if the Department of Agriculture wanted it, it isn't there technically yet. And we're hoping to have that in the next few months, if all goes well with USDA staff and that type of thing. But they do have further questions, you know, like I say, about the usage worldwide, because it's such a big worldwide program. We will be sending another container this time. We haven't decided yet whether it'll be South America or Southeast Asia, but we will be doing this one more container. It'll be a little bit different. It'll be pieces of fillets that are canned. We learned from this last can that using a regular sort of a cross cut of a piece of fish, like a regular canned salmon is, that we're all used to, it didn't work so well in the, we couldn't get accurate weights on the cans. It's just a little too small. That particular piece of equipment that we're using, that type of filler, it's a French Prima filler, they call it, that they use for their boneless salmon products. You just couldn't compress. I won't get into the technicalities of it, but it didn't work as well. And so we modified that by using a fillet machine, which will fillet the fish, and then these are going to go in. It'll be just a solid meat pack in there. It should be just perfect. And since we have a fillet machine, and the whole idea is economic development here and usage into any market in the world, we'll be filleting probably next week. We'll be filleting fish from Dutch Harbor, winter fish from Kodiak, and some spring fish, males, also from the Kodiak area, where they're being stored frozen at the moment. And those will be filleted into shatter packs and held in storage for anybody in the industry, in the seafood industry, no matter who it is, if they'd like some of this to get out to their worldwide customers. The goal is to have these ready for the Boston Seafood Show and the Brussels Seafood Show, and anybody else that wants to get out into the world market in time to possibly start putting herring into the fresh frozen market this spring. That would be the ideal situation, and we have indication that that's entirely possible. As I was saying a little earlier, we don't have enough canned salmon. We just canceled the bid that was, you know, worth several million dollars so far this year. And this is domestic food aid now. The domestic food aid, you know, food banks, those types of things all over the United States, school lunch, other child feeding programs, they need canned fish. They love canned fish in the United States as well. There is no such thing as American tuna fish anymore. Everything the Department of Agriculture buys has to be made in America by Americans for Americans and caught with American boats, the whole deal. And there is no such, this is it. Pink's is it. So they actually came to us last week after hearing about the herring project and have asked us to give them a full presentation in Washington, D.C.
And Representative Grayson Tompkin has a question.
If you were to fully develop this market, how big would it be? How much money are you talking about?
Well, just let's just say if we were going to replace even half, I could easily see $10 million a year in can sales, and the frozen, fresh and frozen sales, I couldn't even tell you, but it sells for about $1.25, $1.30 a pound on the open market. And whether the freight, it's all about freight from Alaska. And if the prices continually rise on the, you know, in the fresh and frozen market, it's very foreseeable that our product can now absorb those freight prices and still make a profit. So, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars, I think is reasonable by the time we get all fixed up. So, they want to look at USDA, and that was the last thing I had for you on this particular project, and I see we're almost out of time, and that'll be just about right for this little briefing on the powder that we're just starting. USDA Domestic has asked for a full presentation to eat it, look at it, feel it, touch it, rub on it, whatever they want to do to look at starting to include this into the domestic programs. It's all beyond anything that we ever thought was going to happen this quickly. So as we move into phase two this spring, on into, you know, for the next year, I think some of these things are all going to start to happen, and we could have commercial sales as early as early summer. We have one other project that we're just getting started on. This is dealing with the massive demand for high nutrition products in the world food business, food aid business, the World Food Program. I mean, everybody is looking, because freight costs so much. That's one drawback about the canned product, is it's heavy. And there's a tremendous amount of product development going on around the food aid business, looking for these super nutrition products in powder form. We've identified the potential from to make a powder out of some of the waste products. For example, heads and frames from the fillet programs, and to turn that process that into a powder. It's our intent to have this powder for more sampling and into a full-blown demonstration project, much like this herring project or the salmon projects that we've done. We'll be starting that early this summer, I hope. We have had samples of it out. It's actually been around for a long time. This was being produced, 15, 20 years ago. But it's sort of like, there's a time for everything. And this seems to be a time now for this to happen. We've had Nina's been able to take this to this list, these countries here. She's had the powder out over the last 3 or 4 years as samples, and into the world conventions where several thousand people from all over the world are there, and everyone's extremely excited about it. So we'll be putting this together. We're going to use salmon as the primary source for this powder. And once we get past that, then you start looking at things where the real hype is to be able to take not only something that is super high protein, 70-80% pure protein, and no weight to it, but something that they can also add micronutrients, vitamins, that type of thing too. So it's very, very exciting. We've had people already come to us looking to purchase the product as soon as it's available.
And we have a question from Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question.
How do you make the powder? Is it something that you grind up and flash freeze, dry, and then?
Well, it goes through a, there are several different things going on with potential. There's a company that's just doing actually just the dried fish, but then there's another company that is actually breaking it down with enzymes, and then after that it's stabilized and dried into a powder, and we're working with them to identify the something that's economical too. That's the point. We're out to do this for economic development for the state and to create jobs and to create new value. And so we're trying to identify the process that doesn't cost more than the product is worth, and also something that can happen virtually today, and it could happen in almost any place in Alaska. So this time next year I'll have a full blown. I'll be able to answer that question. I'll bring a chemist with me that's figured it out. But we do have several different options available with some of the seafood companies that are fooling around with this now, enough to make samples and get out to see what the different sections of the food aid community think of it. We do have just a few pictures. We'll just take you. It's about a 3-minute deal that you might enjoy. It's pretty neat to see people enjoying this kind of product and what it's actually. I don't even. Did you ever find out where the T-shirt came from? They ran across this little African kid that had an Alaska T-shirt on over in Liberia, and I don't think they ever found out where it came from. But obviously, one of our biggest supporters, and. As it turns out, we run into that kind of thing all over the world. Alaska is more famous than even we know. So these are just the products that we've been using, and some pretty neat photos from all over the world, different countries where we've actually been doing some of this. We have had these different focus groups for the last 3 or 4 years on both the powder and the different canned herring and salmon products. We were in South Africa. We've been in 3 or 4 countries there. These are the cases of herring right there. There's 24 cans. 6-ounce cans in one of those cases.
And all the women carry it on their heads, and this little girl was just mimicking her mother. This is in Liberia. I don't know if you saw those little packets, the Maggi cubes, and it's basically MSG and some flavoring, and they use that in all their dishes for seasoning. And the powder could replace that because it's very flavorful. You can also make the powder without the flavor. You can take the flavor out, but in Liberia, as I said, they love it.
They liked it in South America too. It was interesting. They'd take this seafood powder, this stuff we had for samples.
They're making it.
Yeah, they sprinkle it on all their vegetables and stuff and call it a seafood salad.
And here they're preparing it in Laos for a school lunch. This is actually canned salmon from a couple years ago. Cambodia, that was when Bruce mentioned the first place, that was where they started. Uganda, this was the pilot project that we did with a canned salmon and a bit of herring. And it's funny because everybody says, oh, Africa, they're not, what are they going to like canned salmon for? And clearly they can sardines, they eat canned tuna, they eat all kinds of canned fish. Why not Alaskan?
Yeah. We took it up to the, 14,000 feet in Bolivia.
They don't have to boil the water, so it's very economical for them. They could open the can and just spread it on their tortillas, on their bread.
This was the first prototype we had, 2009.
For the powder?
Yeah.
You know, one outfit was just totally into, you know, one of the interesting things about nutrition is, and the people with AIDS and all this type of stuff that they're dealing with, you know, the federal government put some $50 billion into the medication. And without good nutrition, the medication does no good.
Right. And also the medication, once they start feeling better, they get more hungry. So you have to provide food with the medicine. So here you'll get a chance to see the Liberians weighing and measuring. The guy is Paul Foos. He came with us from Tufts University, one of my colleagues, who does a lot of clinical research. And here's one of the Liberian women measuring the kids. That's our team on the left, one of your Native Alaskans at the top, Natalia Povolite. This is the one of the programs in far out Liberia in a place called Foya. That's where the HIV programs were. Here's the Early Child Development Center, where you saw some of the little boy enjoying the herring.
So it's been very exciting. You know, it seems like it gets more complicated and more exciting, but more productive every year. We've been doing this since 2004, almost 10 years. And it's made a big difference. It's brought a lot of value to the seafood industry, to the state. It's allowed a lot of stability in the price of pink salmon. We feel it's going to bring a bunch of stability and new opportunity, especially in Western Alaska, where it's really needed so bad, and some new job opportunities and new value. So, so far, Plan A is working, and thanks to you guys for your support on this thing to make it happen. The kind of economic development you're looking for the economy in the state is benefiting. I think your return on investment is being realized and is going to really ramp up here in the next couple of years.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much. It's you know, it's really tough to figure out how to create new industry, new jobs, economic development. It's one of those things that is a long-term process, and you've been at it for a while, and it looks like it's going in a great direction for Alaska as well as for the recipients of that. So we really appreciate you coming in and updating us on where that is, and keep us informed as it goes along. Does anyone have any other questions? And thanks. We really appreciate the work that ASME's been doing, economic development's what it's about. And it's really nice to see when people come forward that are actually out there doing it. So with that, we'll be adjourned at 11:55.